I'm Indy Todd, and welcome to The Point. Today, we talk about ocean chemistry. Extreme weather events are becoming more common. As scientists learn more about the global water cycle, we may be able to predict droughts and floods in the future. Changes in ocean salinity and ocean acidification are two results of global warming that could have major implications on how we live, work, and what we eat. Joining us to talk about climate change and ocean chemistry is Ray Schmidt, senior scientist and oceanographer at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Good morning, Ray.
Good morning, Mindy.
In a couple of minutes, we'll bring in Sarah Cooley, who's an ocean acidification scientist at HUI, and also Kevin Friedland, a researcher at NOAA. But let's start, Ray, with when we hear this term climate change, a lot of people think of it simply as warming temperatures, melting polar ice, and rising sea levels. But our planet is an interconnected system of atmosphere, ocean, and landmass. So let's start with a big picture view of climate change.
Sure, Mindy. We know because of the increasing amount of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere that the Earth's radiation balance is changing. And what this means is that we're trapping more heat in the ocean, in the atmosphere. And because of the large heat capacity of water, most of this heat is going into the ocean. People estimate that 90% of the heat of global warming over the past 50 years has gone into the ocean. So a small change in the temperature of the ocean is equivalent to a very large change in the temperature of the atmosphere. Now, the atmosphere and the ocean have to work together. They're the two fluids that can move heat from the tropics to the poles. Earth radiates heat out into space pretty uniformly around the globe, but we know it gets more heat input at low latitudes than at high latitudes. So we have to transfer the heat from the tropics to the poles. And the ocean does this with slow-moving currents with great heat capacity. The atmosphere does it with fast-moving air currents with relatively low heat capacity, and they also can carry moisture. So a couple of consequences of that rising ocean temperatures in the Arctic, we're watching the polar ice cap melt. The sea ice is melting because the ocean temperatures have risen. And then the land ice on Greenland, where it flows into the ocean in these deep fjords around the coast of Greenland, they're quite deep, 1,000 meters deep. And now they're encountering very warm water, like 4 degrees centigrade, which is about 39 Fahrenheit. And it used to be zero-degree water, so it wasn't causing the ice to melt. Now this warmer water is causing the glacial ice in those fjords to retreat more rapidly. So the two things, the melting glacial ice is adding to sea level rise, and also the added heat to the ocean causes thermal expansion, and that contributes to sea level rise. Mm. And, of course, there are a lot of other consequences as well.
Very interconnected, and we're going to get into a lot of that this morning. This week, we're in the middle of a heat wave. We don't know if this particular weather system is caused by climate change, but we do know that climate change is altering global weather patterns. So explain how and why.
Well, that's a really interesting topic and quite an active area of research. If you're a sailor around here in Cape Waters and you've gone through, say, Woods Hole or some of the other holes down the Elizabeth Islands, you know that when the current is going against the wind, the waves really build up to high amplitude. Well, something similar seems to be happening in the atmosphere. We know at our latitude we have the jet stream, which is a strong current of air that flows from west to east, and that current is driven by the temperature difference between the tropics and the poles. Well, the Arctic is warming faster than the rest of the globe. And so the temperature difference has been decreasing. So the current, the jet stream currents are predicted to slow down with this acceleration of warming in the Arctic. What we have in a lot of our weather, day-to-day weather, is related to waves in the atmosphere. And those waves, we call them planetary waves, in the nature of their physics, they always propagate from east to west. And so you have the waves sort of propagating against the current. Now, most of the time, the current is going fast enough that our weather gets carried. Our weather, for all of my life, has been coming from the west to the east. But it seems like the jet stream currents have slowed down enough so that the waves are slowing. They'll actually freeze in place, And even back up, this high-pressure system that we're under right now backed in from the east, which is very unusual. Most of our systems come from the west. So this slowing of the jet stream seems to be leading to this what we call blocking highs, weather patterns staying in place for a long time. And over the past few years, we've seen really severe heat waves in Europe, in Russia, a very wet pattern in Pakistan, major flooding. When those atmospheric waves stay in place, they get really large amplitudes, mm-hmm. which means the jet stream is meandering north and south and causing a lot of dryness in the west, and we're getting a lot of rain here in the east.
Right. And we've always had extreme weather, but it seems like these 100-year storms that we used to see, whether they're, you know, droughts or snowstorms or what have you, they seem to be more frequent.
Right. And, you know, every climate system has a distribution of, say, temperature or rainfall. And what we've done is we moved the scientists talk about a Gaussian distribution. If you just move the mean a little bit, shift the mean to a higher average temperature, then even with the weather distributions the same, you find you're breaking high record temperatures much more frequently than you're breaking low record temperatures. The extremes really get accentuated. And, of course, another aspect of all this is how the higher water temperatures contribute to more moisture in the atmosphere and intensification of the water cycle.
Right. Which is that? Does that explain that? When you look at just how it rains, they used to have this soft rain, and now it seems more of our rainstorms are this hard rain that doesn't, you know, necessarily soak into the ground. It's more runoff.
Yeah. One of the basic physical facts of the water molecule is that when it's at a higher temperature, it has a higher vapor pressure, so it's easier to evaporate at higher temperatures. And we all know this. It's dry in the winter. It's more humid in the summer. So as you raise the average temperature of the Earth, the greater humidity in the atmosphere goes up 7% per degree centigrade. 7% is a large change in moisture capacity of the atmosphere. So what's been really interesting and exciting in the past few years, oceanographers, we've been looking at salinity patterns in the ocean. And what we've found is that the areas that have traditionally been salty are getting even saltier. And the areas that were fresh are getting even fresher. So, and because most of the water exchange is between ocean and atmosphere, and most of it occurs over the ocean, this is really the best evidence we have for an acceleration of the water cycle, the intensification of the water cycle. So what this means is wet areas will get wetter and dry areas will get drier. And we're seeing this in the ocean. The salty areas are getting saltier and the fresh areas are getting fresher.
You've been working on a NASA-funded research project to shed new light on this link between ocean salinity and shifts in global precipitation patterns. So tell us about this project and why NASA is involved.
Well, about 2 years ago, NASA put up the first ever salinity sensing satellite. And it's up there and it's doing pretty well. And in order to strengthen their interpretation of the data, NASA, really for the first time in a long time, is putting a fair bit of research dollars into oceanography. They funded some ship time for us. We had a big cruise on the Noor back last fall. And then we had another cruise on the Rhode Island Endeavor ship just this spring. And there was another cruise this coming fall. And what we did, we went out to this the saltiest part of the North Atlantic Ocean. It's about over a week's steam to leave Woods Hole and get out there. And this is a very salty patch. And when we got out there, we were really quite surprised to find that it was much saltier than it had ever been observed before. Now, we sort of anticipated that this could happen because of the trends, but we broke a record in terms of what we observed in terms of the highness of the salinity in this high salinity region. So what we're trying to learn is what are the ocean processes that help to maintain that high salinity, And are there changes in the ocean that are contributing to the higher salinity, or is it purely a change in the atmospheric circulation and intensification of evaporation out there?
So do you plan to go take measurements then in some of the low salinity areas?
Well, we hope to. We're still very preliminary planning stages for that. But yes, we'd like to. And when you go out there, we're going out with new tools, a lot of robotic tools. I think NASA liked the idea that we could have satellites in the ocean. So we have these robotic instruments that are out there, and they're out there for the whole time. They're moving around on their own. One of them's driven by the wave energy. And it's called a wave glider, and it just steams around in its own little pattern, going at one or two knots, they're unstoppable. It's really marvelous to see this new technology.
Yeah, amazing how things have changed from when you started this research.
Oh, yes. When I started doing oceanography, we were still using thermometers and bottles.
So scientists believe that the ocean stores a better record of global precipitation levels. Can you explain why and how we access that information?
Well, I like to say that over 90% of the water cycle is over the ocean. You know, that's where the water on the planet is. 97% of the water on the planet is in the ocean. And, of course, we just care about how much it rains on land. No, nobody has cared very much how much it rains on the ocean.
Unless you're out there fishing or something.
Yeah. I tell you, it rains a lot on the Gulf Stream. I've been out there a lot. So oceanographers are the only people who care about rainfall in the ocean. And someone interested in salinity, such as myself, are really the only reason you would be concerned about rainfall on the ocean. So I start looking at this, over 20 years ago. And because nobody looked at it, it was all new stuff. And, I came to realize that the important processes in the water cycle are really going on in the ocean. In fact, most of the rainfall that we get on land has evaporated from the surface of the ocean. Mm-hmm. And for many years, meteorologists have known that if you have a good idea of the patterns of sea surface temperature around the global ocean, you can do a pretty good job of predicting where and when it's going to rain in various land regions. So people are beginning to appreciate the importance of oceanographic information for understanding the water cycle. And in fact, you have to deal across cultural boundaries within science. And, the hydrologists just sort of don't care very much about what's going on in the ocean. But we created a map of evaporation and precipitation over the North Atlantic, and we put in the continents with their true color. And we could see that the transition in the ocean from net rainfall to net evaporation occurred exactly at the same place in Africa, where the color from space changed from green to brown.
Wow.
Up into the Sahara. Mm-hmm. And those regions where there's a sharp demarcation between rainfall and net evaporation, called the Sahel region of Africa. If the Atlantic sea surface temperatures change a little bit, that will affect their rainfall immensely.
Wow.
So we have people now at the Oceanographic that are studying those processes.
Rising sea temperatures, even a degree or two, have implications for the marine food chain. And joining us on the phone is Kevin Friedland, a researcher at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning.
So your research looks at how changing ocean water temperatures and circulation patterns have profoundly affected zooplankton species in recent decades, and that may be influencing the recovery of Atlantic cod. So tell us a little bit more about your research.
Well, we were interested in the finer scale trends in temperature in our northeast shelf area, which we refer to as the northeast shelf large marine ecosystem. And it's the northeast shelf along with the Bering Strait are the two ecosystems in U.S. waters that are warming most rapidly. But when we looked at recent decades, we saw some interesting things occur. The temperature that we recorded in 2012 in the northeast shelf was a record high, and it was associated with a dramatic jump in temperature recorded both in, from the satellite data but also from shipboard measurements as well. But the decades preceding 2012 were a period of, steady increase in temperature, which were interesting in their own right. And what the properties of that period, what made them so interesting, is that while the ecosystem was warming, we were seeing a divergence in the minimum and maximum temperatures within the ecosystem. And when we've had past increases in temperature back like in the 1940s and 50s, both minimum and maximum temperatures increased in unison. And we were sort of curious about why there was this recent decoupling of the minimum and maximum temperatures. So we took a closer look and visualized temperature in a different way, and we computed what we call thermal habitat, which is just simply the quantity of the ocean surface within a thermal range. And we did this for the period 1982 to 2011, sort of predating that 2012 really warm event. And what we found, not surprisingly for an ecosystem that is warming, is that warm water habitats were increasing, and cool water habitats, and cool water, I mean the most, sort of the mid-range ones, which are the most abundant ones in the ecosystem, there was no big surprise there. They were decreasing concomitantly. But what was interesting was that the cold water habitats in the ecosystem slightly increased or were remaining relatively high. So this was suggesting that there was a added force that was constricting the amount of these core thermal habitats in the Northeast Shelf ecosystem. And so we started to look at other aspects of the ecosystem to see if this constriction was having an effect. And the first place we started was to look at the base of the food chain and was to examine abundance trends that we were seeing in zooplankton species. And zooplankton is a general term that refers to these small drifting animals that live in the water column. And the species that really caught our eye was a species, a copepod species called Pseudocalanus. And copepods are small crustaceans. Pseudocalanus is about a half a millimeter or about a 32nd of an inch. You can just barely see it. But they feed on the microscopic plant life that's in the ocean and in turn are preyed upon by other fish and invertebrate species. So they're a very integral, abundant and integral part of the food chain. And Pseudocalanus caught our eye because it's not only one of the most abundant species on our Northeast Shelf, so it plays that critical role, but it's also critical to the larval feeding of cod. So we became interested in what's been occurring with that species spatially. And what we found was that Pseudocalanus abundances were becoming spatially constricted in recent decades in that their abundances remained high in the core area of their distribution on the Northeast Shelf, which we would describe as southern New England, Nantucket Shoals, and Damass Bay. But they declined in abundance very dramatically in eastern Gulf of Maine and Georges Bank and the Mid-Atlantic Bight. And that though we measured these factors, the temperature and the zooplankton directly, and though we did not measure the linkage to cod directly, but the implications we drew from the data was that those areas where Pseudocalanus had declined were also areas where larval cod survival was probably not being favored. We did see evidence of poor larval survival of cod in that the sense that the areas where Pseudocalanus was low were also areas where cod abundance during that time period was low or declining.
Yeah. Now, your research looked at zooplankton, but there have been some dramatic changes in the phytoplankton blooms in the Gulf of Maine between last year and this year. So what can you tell us about the phytoplankton blooms and what are those implications?
Well, as soon as we sort of concentrated on this period that I would generally describe as the mid-90s to 2011, which we've been focusing on, we have this dramatic change in conditions that occurred in 2012, the warmest temperatures recorded. And in case in point, and what we're starting to look at, the range of things we're starting to look at, in 2012 we had the earliest and one of the highest magnitude spring blooms of phytoplankton in the Gulf of Maine. This is a tremendous accumulation of biomass, tremendous productivity that will rain down and feed the food chain and organisms that all through from invertebrates to fish and things that we depend upon as well. This past winter, the mixing events that occurred in the Gulf of Maine were also record-breaking in the sense that we saw really deep water mixing, and analyses that we're just doing right now of the spring bloom in the Gulf of Maine show that in contrast to 2012, 2013, there was virtually no bloom in the Gulf of Maine. What evidence of a slight increase occurred in one of the latest time frames we've ever seen, and very, very low biomasses. So that pulse of energy into the ecosystem is going to be absent in 2013 for that particular region. So these are perturbations that we're just starting to examine and try to understand what the impacts are.
Kevin Friedland, researcher at NOAA. Thanks so much, Kevin, for joining us. Appreciate your research.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Point. We're discussing ocean chemistry and climate change with Ray Schmidt, senior scientist and oceanographer at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, and Sarah Cooley, research associate and ocean acidification scientist at HUI. Welcome, Sarah.
Good morning,
Mindy. Sarah, talk a little bit about ocean acidification. It's another result of our changing climate. Explain what it is and why it's a concern.
That's right. As we are releasing more carbon dioxide to the atmosphere because of our fossil fuel use, our land use changes, our industrial activities, about a quarter to a third of that carbon dioxide that first goes to the atmosphere winds up going into the ocean. And when it goes into the ocean, it creates an acid called carbonic acid. And that acid is lowering the pH of ocean waters. And the reaction of that acid with the seawater is also sopping up some of the carbonate ions that are normally available in the ocean. And those carbonate ions are important to ocean life because they are one of the building blocks of calcium carbonate, hard shells, and skeletons that many marine animals use to protect themselves. A lot of animals in the mollusk taxon use these hard shells and skeletons. Think of an oyster or a clam or a sea urchin. They all have these hard calcium carbonate shells. Corals also make calcium carbonate skeletons. And so because ocean acidification is taking away the building block that those animals need to make those hard parts, life is getting much harder for those animals. It's much harder for them to grow and develop the way that they normally do. So this is becoming a real emerging issue of concern. Chemical oceanographers have known for decades that the ocean would take up carbon dioxide as sort of a favor to the Earth. It kind of helps modulate the Earth's climate, the Earth's balance of carbon dioxide. But now that humans have entered the picture and we've started releasing carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, we're kind of throwing that system out of balance. And the ocean is sort of still trying to do this service, still trying to take up that carbon dioxide. But the rate of change that we're causing with our human activities is so fast that this ocean acidification is sort of a byproduct of this. And it's really throwing things off. Exactly. It's throwing things off for the marine life.
Yeah. You mentioned the mollusks, and I'm wondering, are you seeing, I guess, do we have a baseline to say, obviously there's been, you know, ocean acidification for a while, but we haven't been really studying it for that long. So do we know, you know, as you're looking at, you know, how this is impacting this marine life, do we know where we're at? I mean, where's that tipping point? You know what I mean?
That's a really good question. And there are a lot of scientists working very hard on figuring out what normal actually is for these animals. We have long-term data series in particularly open ocean regions that have been looking at temperature, salinity, carbon content of the ocean for decades. And so we have this long-term open ocean record. In the coastal regions, though, where most of these organisms live, we have much more short-term records, partly because the instrumentation to measure a lot of these things is very expensive, partly because the coastal regions are so variable over such a short time and space that it's really hard to sample everything with enough density to understand what's going on. So there's a tremendous international effort going on right now to understand what is going on, what is our baseline for ocean acidification. So there are many, many different activities around the world trying to measure the baseline conditions. And there are also a lot of laboratory experiments going on right now trying to understand what normal conditions consist of for these animals and what will push them beyond their normal comfort level.
Yeah. We tend to think of the ocean as this one big unified body of water, but as Ray described earlier, the chemistry of the world's oceans and coastal waters can vary greatly depending on where they are in the globe. There are a number of things that impact ocean chemistry, but when we're looking at the ocean acidification or the lowering of the pH of the water, what are some of the characteristics of the water that make it better able to buffer itself against acidification?
Well, there are acid-base equilibria in the seawater normally that prevent it from changing pH too much. But the primary chemical system that guards against pH change is what we call the carbonate system. And that is the acid-base system that we're monkeying with when we put more carbonic acid into the system. So we're basically putting a wrench on one of the biggest levers we have in terms of pH control. So ocean alkalinity sort of buffers against pH change, but we're overwhelming that with our messing with it.
Last week, we spoke with Alec Wang, a chemical oceanographer at HUIS, whose research looks at how sensitive the waters off the east coast of the U.S. may be to ocean acidification. He and his team sampled water from the Gulf of Mexico up to the Gulf of Maine to determine its ability to buffer or resist changes in acidity. I began our conversation by asking him what they found as they moved up the east coast.
So we found many interesting aspects in terms of carbon chemistry. But one important finding is that we found the northeast coast, the region like Gulf of Maine and the Middle Atlantic Bight between Cape Cod and the North Carolina, has relatively low pH, calcium carbonate saturation, and buffer capacity. So what it means that compared to other regions along the East Coast, this region is more susceptible to ocean acidification pressure if ocean acidification continues. And particularly, Gulf of Maine has the lowest pH, calcium carbonate saturation, and buffer capacity on average among all East Coastal regions.
So basically, we have more acid already in our waters here than, say, the Gulf of Mexico.
Yeah, not just like that. And so low pH, as well as it has lower capability to buffer further pH change. So that's a concern to me.
So do we know why the northern waters may have less of a capacity to buffer itself against acidification?
That is a very good question. I don't have a clear answer to it. It may be related to the sources, source water of the region. Maybe the source water already low pH, you know, buffer capacity and all that. But it's very important to find out why this is the case. I think more importantly, is that we want to study how the chemistry going to change in the future. So we already have a sensitive region, and how that going to change in the near future. And that have, you know, very have potential impacts on a lot of things in this region.
Yeah. So so your work is continuing this summer, and you're going to be taking a closer look at water chemistry and shellfish and trying to answer some of these questions then.
Yeah, we have a pilot study just started in the summer, and the basically looking at all of that issues. I have collaborators at Woods Hole and other places, and we went out to the middle of the Gulf of Maine. And then take samples from surface all the way to the bottom. And then we'll measure chemistry as well as the biology and try to figure out whether the water is already corrosive to calcium carbonate shells. And then if it does, what effect may be to the animals.
And I guess the other big question here is this research is relatively new. So the baseline is tough to tell, right? Because we don't know when this really began.
The study we done in the past is kind of set up a baseline study, so that we can compare in the future what is the pH or the carbon chemistry going to change along the road. But we don't know whether what we measure now is already changed or not. My guess is it's already changed, but I don't know how much it already changed compared to the original background value.
Alec Wang is a chemical oceanographer at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Thanks so much for coming in and sharing your research with us.
Thank you.
We're talking about ocean chemistry and climate change. Our toll-free number, if you'd like to join our conversation, is 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@wgbh.org. Sarah, studying coastal waters is perhaps more complicated than studying offshore waters in that there's so many variables that can impact those waters, runoff, pollution, other human activities. So tell us more about your modeling project, which hopes to factor in some of those variables when we look at ocean acidification in coastal waters.
Right now, my colleagues and I are putting together a project where we are using a high-resolution three-dimensional ocean model that looks at the east coast of the United States, and it faithfully replicates the physics of the ocean in that area, and it also includes a simplified representation of the biological activity. So it kind of looks at what we call the lower trophic levels, or the phytoplankton, the zooplankton, and none of the top predators. And so what we are doing is we are using the model to help us understand which factors have the greatest potential to adjust pH and saturation state. One thing that chemical oceanographers talk about quite a lot regarding ocean acidification is called saturation state of calcium carbonate minerals. And basically what that is it's a measure of how favorable the water is to minerals, to keeping these carbonate minerals intact. If that saturation state dips too low, below a threshold of 1, it's a little bit of an arbitrary unitless scale, but if it dips below that level, then the minerals just dissolve on their own. And so what we want to do is look at how freshwater runoff, how nutrient overloading and phytoplankton production and microbial respiration are changing the carbon dioxide balance of these waters. And we want to understand exactly which factors are the most important, because we find that in some areas there could be these local factors that are controllable by other measures. And so we can maybe think about how to reduce overall pressures on the coastal systems by making sure we don't have excessive nutrient runoff, or making sure we don't divert too much water, or we don't run off too much, you know, divert water so that we get a gigantic outflow in one spot. And these could be local measures that regions could take to kind of strengthen local ecosystems in the ocean against things like ocean acidification, which are progressive and kind of coming down from above, and climate change as well, which are caused by these external global factors, and yet they're playing out on this very local scale.
And Ray, this also impacts your research as well when we're talking about coastal waters versus offshore.
Well, one of the results of intensification of the water cycle is increased runoff, and because more of it's associated with these extreme events, we often have flooding events that will overwhelm the sewage system of a city, say, and you have this big nutrient pulse into the coastal waters, and that can overload, you know, well, lead to hypoxia, which is lack of oxygen because there's so much plant material been produced, it decays and consumes all the oxygen in its use. So,
there are so many impacts of climate change. Let's talk about a few that have major implications for our supply of protein and economic revenue. First, commercial fishing. Sarah, you've been using ocean models and fisheries data sets to get a better grasp of this issue. What can you tell us?
Yeah, one of my major research interests is to examine how changes in ocean chemistry and biogeochemistry, which is sort of the flow of things like carbon and nitrogen, other elements that are important to life, through the ocean, and how they could affect the ocean life, and then how humans actually depend on that ocean life. And so one of our major studies recently looked at how ocean acidification had the potential to affect human communities. And what we did was we examined forecasts for ocean chemistry, and we connected them with the research findings of several colleagues who were looking at specific effects of ocean acidification on mollusk species. And knowing that 20% of the world gets its protein from fish and fisheries resources, we looked a little bit more closely at the dependence of human communities on those resources. And right now, because the understanding of how ocean acidification is going to affect mollusks is best developed, we focused only on mollusks for that study. In the future, we hope to maybe extend that study and look at higher trophic levels, or basically organisms higher up in the food web, as we understand how trophic relationships may change if links in the food chain are taken out or diminished. And so so what we find with that kind of research is that typically nations that are least developed are going to be hardest hit, because they have the greatest dependence on the fewest number of resources. And so we find coastal nations, developing island nations, could all be very hard hit by this. At the same time, these nations are dealing with a bunch of other factors. They're dealing with widespread environmental degradation. They may be dealing with sea level rise. They may be having a hard time just growing protein on land, so they have to turn to the seas. So this is actually a really compelling area for me to look into, because it really brings together sort of the cycle of life and energy on the earth, which I think is fascinating.
And then, of course, we're talking some of these developing nations with the weather patterns we were talking about earlier. So we add that on to all of this.
That's
as well.
Right.
Yes. The island nations are really going to be impacted by sea level rise. And then some areas are just going to get drier and drier. And so they're going to have major problems with water supply or oversupply. You know,
right.
A wet place like Southeast Asia, which gets these heavy monsoons. If the monsoon comes on too strong and too intense, you get major flooding, cholera outbreaks.
Right.
It's changing the water cycle is a big problem for mankind.
And then another implication with a significant economic impact is the effect of acidification on tourism and the protection of shorelines by coral reefs. Well, we don't really have it here on the Cape and Islands, but we certainly rely on tourists attracted to our marine resources to drive our economy. And we could probably do a whole show just on the coral reef situation. But, I mean, they're like a rainforest of the sea. That's where all the biodiversity is, right?
That's right. They're these hot spots of diversity, and they're nurseries for young fish. There are these very unique ecosystems. And what we find is that if coral reefs are excessively damaged by acidification or bleaching or the combination of the two, which actually is turning out to be more than one plus one, it's additively much worse for the coral reefs. We find that the reefs are not able to recover. There's been a lot of evidence suggesting that the reefs are then more likely to be overtaken by macroalgae. So these sort of, you know, squishy, kelpy environments, very different from these hard, stony coral environments that we're accustomed to thinking about. And that could be a real blow for nations that are dependent on coral tourism. But in addition to, we do actually have coral reefs up here in New England. There are these cold water coral reefs. And while they're not tourism hotspots, they are nurseries for young fish. And we don't fully understand the ecosystem consequences or ecosystem benefits, I guess, that these reefs provide yet. But we know that they are seen associated with all of these young fish. And so it seems as though if the cold water coral reefs in New England do badly, our fish stocks could do badly as well. But again, that's an emerging area of research. So more to come on that, certainly.
You're listening to The Point. We're talking about ocean chemistry and climate change with Sarah Cooley, Research Associate and Ocean Acidification Scientist at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, and Ray Schmidt, Senior Scientist and Oceanographer, also at HUI. Putting a price tag on these issues is difficult, but it's essential as we weigh the different options for dealing with climate change. Sarah, trying to figure out the costs of climate change is also part of your work. Can you explain a little bit more how you do this and how we share this information?
This is a difficult business. One of the easiest ways to begin this investigation is to start with things that have a monetary value. And the most obvious thing that we get from the ocean that has a monetary value is fisheries harvests. And we know that that's big business. In New England, it's huge business. And in 2011, I believe the dockside revenues of the entire country for fisheries revenues was $5.3 billion. So that's really quite a chunk of change. And regionally, it breaks down to be, you know, show that New England, it's, you know, and this is just sort of what fishermen get at the dock to sell their catch. This is not including wholesale and retail and, you know, value added and things like that. So so that's a complicated business, just trying to assess the amount of money involved with that. And then when we start thinking about other things that are much harder to put price tag on, the difficulty grows exponentially. Some of the ways that we can try to get at this is to look at things that economists call opportunity costs and things like that, which is basically how much would people pay to have a recreational opportunity? How much do they pay to have certain recreational opportunities? Or how much would they pay to preserve an option? But again, this still comes back to money. It still puts everything in monetary terms. And there's been quite a lot of discussion lately about how to broaden that conversation when we're talking about environmental resources and how do we value them. And there's quite a lot of work being done to not only do the economic valuation, but also do what we call non-economic valuation, which involves different approaches, much more borrowed from other social sciences than economics, to try to elicit from people what the cultural meaning is of a resource or what is the heritage value. And, you know, you could see some of this coming out in the previous interviews and pieces that you've had in this series where people were talking about, the, you know, well, this is something my family's always done, or, you know, every summer I bring my children to come here and participate in this. And those are the kinds of things that that we're starting to look towards folding into these analyses.
Right. So even if we could immediately halt CO2 emissions, we still would have to deal with the impacts of climate change. So what are some of the ways we can plan ahead to be in a better position to manage the impacts of climate change, maybe on the fisheries and other marine resources?
Well, I think the best, what the world needs now is a carbon tax. I mean, we've got to wean ourselves off fossil fuels, and it's tough to do. I mean, it's intrinsic to our society. We're talking about energy, and the physicist definition of energy is the ability to do work, and so it's really essential for the economy. Right now, we have a very plentiful and cheap natural gas, and that's actually inhibiting progress in some of the alternative energy sources, such as solar and wind and ocean energy. Mm-hmm. That'll be a problem. I also wanted to mention there's a whole field of research called geoengineering where people try to think about how we could deal with continued global warming. And one of the big scary things is if the ice caps really start to melt fast, which they are accelerating, mm-hmm. they are melting faster, sea level could rise many, many feet, which would, you know, put every coastal city in the world out of business. So people talk about trying to prevent that with what they call solar radiation management. And the most popular idea, which is fairly inexpensive to do, is to inject sulfur dioxide way up into the high atmosphere, and that would block sunlight. You would have these hazy skies. We wouldn't be able to see the stars, but it would definitely cool the planet. We know that it would work because volcanoes do it every few years. You get a mm-hmm. couple of cool years after a strong volcanic eruption. So, but the problem with solar radiation management, the CO2 would still be in the atmosphere. And it would still continue to increase with fossil right. fuel use. And so the ocean could get very acidic, even if Greenland doesn't melt.
So, Ray, you sat on the National Academy of Science panel, which was looking at the ocean, how itself might solve some of these problems brought on by climate change. What were some of the panel's findings?
Well, we looked at some of the assessments of how much energy is available in the ocean. This would be wave energy, energy in tidal currents, ocean thermal energy. I mean, what we found was basically this energy is very diffusely distributed. So at any one point, there's not a high concentration of energy. Now, there are a few tidal streams, and it turns out that between Martha's Vineyard and Nantucket is one of those hotspots for really strong tidal currents that might be profitably tapped for tidal energy. But wave energy is very broadly distributed. Yes, there's a lot of energy there, but if you think about what you would have, the infrastructure you'd have to build to capture that energy, it's mind-bogglingly expensive. And as an oceanographer with a lot of experience putting gear in the ocean, it's very difficult and expensive to maintain things in the ocean for any length of time. So it's ocean energy, I think, for the foreseeable future, is going to be a very expensive alternative energy. Wind and solar are going to be a lot easier.
Mm. Is that why we don't hear so much about ocean thermal energy conversion? We don't hear a lot about that. And it's because of the cost factor mostly?
Yes. An ocean thermal energy conversion plant would probably cost $1 billion, and it would just give you 100 megawatts, which is not really that much for $1 billion. It could. People are using the cool water. Let me explain the idea between ocean thermal energy. In the tropics, the surface waters are quite warm, and you don't have to go very deep to get very cold water. Mm. That difference in temperature can be used to run a fairly low efficiency heat engine, but you got to bring up the cold water. There's lots of other things you could do with that cold water. It's nutrient rich. You could get a phytoplankton boom. You could have fisheries build up around one of these OTEC plants. So there's all sorts of interesting ideas there if somebody wanted to spend the money and do the experiments. And then the other problem is you're producing energy out in the ocean where you really want it on land. Mm-hmm. So it's going to work for some tropical island communities. Hawaii is looking at it very seriously, and American Samoa. And the simpler thing that is profitable now is to bring up cold water and use it for air conditioning. In tropical islands, 50% of the energy load is used for air conditioning. All they have to do is pump up cold water and run it through a heat exchanger, and they can save something like it's 50 to 1 over running an air conditioning unit.
Yeah, it's interesting. Climate change, as we know, highly politicized issue. We don't even use the term global warming that much anymore. Do you think climate change will become less political as we see more and more events like, you know, Superstorm Sandy and the deadly tornadoes in the Midwest? And I know we can't blame all of this on climate change, but as people start to go, wait a second, what's happening? Do you see this becoming less politicized, either one of you?
I think when people have a personal connection to something, it's always an eye-opener. You realize the full dimensions of things. So I think people are starting to wonder a bit more. I can't say what the outcome is going to be in the political realm, but I definitely think that the attitudes of people on the ground are changing a bit because they're starting to see effects come closer and closer to home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, look at the wildfires in the West. Mm-hmm. I mean, the West is drying out. Look at the flooding we're having here in the East and the Superstorm Sandy. We've just had one of the wettest Junes on record.
Right.
And when you have, you know, the Northeast is in this getting wetter trend for the last 20 years. And when the soil is already wet and saturated, if we did have a hurricane with a lot of rainfall, there'd be more rapid water would rise quicker. Mm-hmm. The flooding would be a bigger problem just mm-hmm. because the soil is so saturated.
Mm-hmm. Climate change is a global issue, as we've been discussing here, but there's, as we get, no one-size-fits-all solution to dealing with the implication. And again, I guess it will vary region by region. So what are some of the ways science, industry, and government can work together to solve some of these problems brought on by climate change?
We've actually had a really nice example in the Pacific Northwest of that kind of a partnership emerging to handle acute ocean acidification events. Over several years in the early 2000s, prevailing oceanographic and atmospheric conditions caused episodic upwelling on the Pacific Northwest in the Washington-Oregon area. And at the same time, oyster hatchery owners were seeing massive mortality of oyster larvae in their protected tanks, which take in water from the environment. And the ultimate result of that was that we had industry, government, and scientists partnering up to identify what was going on, come up with solutions. The solution was actually to have the hatchery owners close off the intakes at certain times when they would see an upwelling event happening. And now there's work to put in an early warning system of buoys that kind mm-hmm. of indicate when an upwelling event is beginning. So I think that's a really great case study of how successful these types of partnerships can be when they're very targeted.
Yeah,
I think the key is getting the scientific information out to the public.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, perhaps as scientists, we're not all that good at communicating the implications of our data to the general public, but we have to get better at it.
Yeah.
And that's all we can do.
Right. Yeah, just gonna get it out there, right. Ray Schmidt, senior scientist and oceanographer at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Sarah Cooley is research associate and ocean acidification scientist at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Thank you both. Really fascinating work that you both are doing. Appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you, Minnie.
Thank you for having us.
Also, thanks to Kevin Friedland, researcher at NOAA, for joining us, and Alec Wang, chemical oceanographer at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Amy Vins produces The Point, with assistance from Jenny Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.